changed in him. Something had broken. I felt it in the air around our heads. When the tributary opened up upon the pool of water, hedged perfectly by the marsh grass, Whit steered the boat into the very center of it and cut off the engine. The sound died around us as he dropped the anchor line. "Let's go swimming," he said, and began unbuttoning his shirt. I sat speechless as he stood in the boat and stripped completely naked, the most disarming boyishness taking over his face. Then he jumped, cannonball style, over the side, rocking the boat so hard I grabbed onto the gunwales. He came up laughing, shaking his head, the droplets flying off his hair like fracturing glass. "Why are you still sitting there?" he cried, and broke into an accomplished crawl. I peeled off every stitch I had on and jumped. The creek was absolutely freezing, like smacking into a glacier. For a moment, all I could do was tread water, my body shocked wide open. There had been a December, a few years earlier, when Hugh had looked up from the television set and proposed that we go to Lake Lanier on New Year's Day and take part in a polar bear plunge. It involved otherwise normal people throwing themselves into a body of shivering water. I'd looked at him with complete incredulity, unwilling even to consider it. And now, here I was in this bright, cold water. I finally began swimming, not wits-controlled, athletic movement, but playfully diving, just splashing around. The water was turgid like milk coffee and deeper than I'd thought, 15 or 20 feet perhaps. It was exhilarating, as if my body were emphatically awake and singing after a long silence. I caught sight of Whit in the boat with a ragged white towel around his waist. I hadn't realized he'd climbed back in. I dog-paddled over to him, and he pulled me up and draped me in a towel that was only slightly less frayed than his own. "Is monastery linen always so austere?" I joked.
"It's part of our overall body negation program," he said.
He maneuvered the boat to the edge of the island, and we made our way to the hermitage, still wearing our towels, clutching our clothes. He spread a brown blanket in the sun, next to the little hut. Peering inside it, I saw Hepzibah's turtle skull sitting on the crab trap, exactly as I'd left it. As we stretched out on the blanket, side by side, the sky rose over us, marbled with remnants of clouds. I felt woozy for a moment, that sensation you get as a child when you turn in circles and fall over in sweet dizziness. I lay there with wet hair, with mud caked on my feet, and said to him, "All I want is for us to be honest with each other. Brutally honest."
He said, "Brutally?"
I smiled, "Yes, brutally."
"All right," he said, his tone still teasing.
"But I'm generally against brutality in any form."
I fixed my eyes on a fleck of glinting cloud. "I've fallen in love with you," I said. "I wouldn't be out here otherwise." His hands had been tucked behind his head in the most casual way, and he moved them slowly to his sides. He said,
"I know we should be honest about what's going on, but I felt like it would open a door we couldn't close."
"Why would we have to close it?" He sat up, staring ahead with the curve of his back to me.
"But Jesse, what if you walk away from your marriage because of me, and then..." He stopped.
"And then you can't walk away from the Abbey? Is that what you're saying?"
"That's not what I'm saying." He pushed a breath through his mouth. "Okay. You want to know how I feel?"
He sounded provoked, as if he'd been forced out onto a little ledge and seen how far he would have to jump. My throat burned, down in the notch where my collarbones came together.
"I love you too," he said, "and it scares me to death."
The air around us stilled. I could only look at him. His body was shingled with bits of shadow coming from the hermitage behind us.
"But we both know it isn't that simple," he said. "What I meant before was, what if you left your marriage and then, later, you regretted it? I know you said you're separated from Hugh, but how are you going to live with ending your marriage completely? My God, Jesse, how am I going to live with it?
He sighed and his breath fell across my face. I pulled him back down beside me. We lay there and listened to the small, searching sounds of the world.
If we do this, there will be suffering, he said. We'll be damned and saved both.
I know, I told him. I know. He rose up on one elbow and drew me hard against him. I knew he was giving himself over, to me, to us, to whatever would happen. He clutched me, holding the back of my head with his hand. His fingers pressed into my scalp, and his heart pounded, filling my body. We made love in the sun, and afterward, lying on the blanket, I began to cry. A shuddering cry that alarmed Whit at first, but I kept smiling at him with my wet face, saying, "No, no, it's all right. It's because I feel so happy." I hadn't said, "So complete," though I'd wanted to. We got dressed, and he arranged the blanket beneath the hermitage roof out of the sun. As we settled on top of it, he handed me an old-fashioned metal thermos filled with water, then rummaged deeper in his canvas bag. "There's something I want to show you," he said, pulling out two books. "Legenda Aurea, Readings on the Saints, by Jacobus de Voragine." The other title I couldn't see. I looked up some of the saints, the ones who took Jesus too seriously when it came to cutting off the offending member. It pleased me that he wanted to be involved, to help me with Mother. It was only later that I remembered how thoroughly I'd been against Hugh's involvement, and I couldn't account for the difference. "I found a Saint Eudoria in the 12th century who cut off her finger," he said. "She was a prostitute until she was converted by a Franciscan friar."
"A prostitute?"
"Yeah, but that's not the interesting part," he said, though, to be honest, I wasn't so sure. "Supposedly, after she cut off her finger, she planted it in a field, and it sprouted into a sheaf of wheat. Nell could have been planting her finger, not burying it." The thought jolted me a little.
"You think Mother was copying her?"
"In Ireland, there used to be something called white martyrdom," Whit said. "Our abbot is always preaching sermons about it. I'm sure Nell must have heard some of them. It means following in the footsteps of one of the saints, imitating what he or she did." "That sounds like Mother cutting off her finger and planting it because some saint did it 600 years ago." Legenda Aurea had a worn, outdated jacket with a hideous picture of Jesus wearing what looked like a British crown. He lifted a scepter over a throng of kneeling, haloed men. "When I first started looking for this book," Whit said, "I couldn't find it on the shelf, so I went and asked Dominic. He opened his desk drawer, and it was in there, along with this book." He held it out to me. "Indigenous Religious Traditions." Dominic told me Brother Timothy had found both books in the kitchen, right after Nell cut off her finger. Apparently, she'd taken them out of the library. She marked a page in each of them, the one on Saint Eudoria, and then this. He flipped open the second book to a dog-eared page and laid it across my lap. I stared at an illustration of a mermaid whose fingers were depicted as dolphins, seals, fish, whales. What is this?
"Her name's Sedna. She's an Inuit sea goddess. All of her fingers were severed. All 10.
I read the text under the picture, a magical if slightly horrifying story. A young woman sends word to her father to come rescue her from a cruel husband. They are fleeing in his boat when her husband pursues them. Fearing for his life, the father throws his daughter overboard, but she grabs on to the side of the boat and refuses to let go. Panicked, her father cuts off each of her fingers, one by one." I read the last couple of sentences out loud.
Sinking into the ocean, Sedna became a powerful female deity with the head and torso of a woman and the tail of a fish or a seal. She came to be known as Mother of the Ocean, her severed fingers becoming the sea creatures that filled the waters. There was a sidebar accompanying the story about the number 10. I suppose because she'd lost 10 fingers, I skimmed it. 10 was considered the holiest number. Pythagoreans deemed it the number of regeneration and fulfillment. Everything sprang from 10. I stared at Sedna's image, her hair in long braids, her strong Inuit face. She's not exactly a Catholic saint. But she could have reminded Nell of Saint Sinara, Witt said, before she was converted, when she was still Asinara, the mermaid. I shuddered, and he slid over and drew me against him. We sat in silence for a while. I couldn't talk about it anymore, this martyring side of my mother. A breeze had come up and was flapping the sides of the blanket. I noticed that the light had dissolved a little. Witt said, I hate to say this, but I need to go. He tucked the books back into his bag, screwed the top onto the thermos, folded the blanket that I was sure had come off his bed. He did this without speaking, and I watched his hands, how they scissored through the air. The skin tanned like parchment, the fingers long and roughened with small calluses. I put my hand on his arm. Will it be hard going to the choir now and praying after this? Yes, he said, not looking at me. When we got to the water's edge, I saw that it was slack tide, those few suspended moments between ebb and flow. My father had called it the turnbout. He'd beckoned me and Mike out of the yard one day and marched us down to Caw Caw Creek so we could see it. We'd stared at the rising tide water, utterly bored, Mike throwing mud snails across the surface, making them skip. When the current finally reached the end of its driving, the whole creek grew perfectly still. Not one floating blade of spartina grass moved. And then, minutes later, as if some maestro had gestured, all the water began to roll in the opposite direction, moving back out. Witt steered the boat into the tributary that crooked left into the creek. Overhead, gulls wheeled through the sky, and behind us, the small marsh island tilted away. I could feel him slipping again into his monk's life, the ocean turning around us, the ruthless ebb and flow. Chapter 27 Witt. Witt stood outside the abbot's office on the first day of spring, clutching a note that had been placed in his hands by Brother Bede, the abbot's diminutive secretary. He'd passed it to Witt just before the office of Terse, whispering, "The abbot wishes to see you immediately after choir." Witt had folded it up with a hot, tremulous feeling in his stomach. After prayers were over, he'd followed Bede through the transept of the church to Dom Anthony's office. Though he tried to read Bede's face when they reached the door, scanning the impossibly small forehead and the pea-sized green eyes, he could see nothing telling in them. "The abbot will call for you in a moment," Bede told him, and ambled away, the hem of his robe dragging on the hall carpet. Now he waited, the kind of waiting that is crusted over with false calm, but underneath tosses around violently. He heard a sharp, serrated buzzing and walked to the window in the corridor. One of the monks was taking down a dead crepe myrtle with a chainsaw. Had he been summoned because of Jesse? Because Father Sebastian had read his notebook that night he'd come to his cottage? When Dom Anthony opened the door, he nodded once, his Irish face stern and chafed cherry pink across his cheeks. Witt gave him a little bow before stepping inside. There was a painting behind the abbot's desk that Witt loved, an annunciation in which Mary is so shocked by Gabriel's news of her impending motherhood that she drops the book she's reading. It spills from her hand, which hangs suspended in the air. Her lips are parted, her eyes shocked and deer-like.
Whit glanced up at the picture, seeing for the first time the look of complete dread on her face. He felt sorry for her suddenly, bearing God. It was too much to ask. Dom Anthony sat down behind the mahogany desk, but Whit went on standing, waiting. He felt regretful, sorry it would end like this. He wondered how he could go back out there, to Rambo movies and Boy George on the radio, to Tammy Faye Baker's streaked face on television. How could he go back to all that greed and consumption? The stock market had crashed last October, plunged 500 points. He'd read it in the papers, and it hadn't even fazed him. If he returned to the world, he'd have to think about the economy, about starting up his law practice again. Through the window on his right, he glimpsed a wedge of sapphire sky, and it made him think of the rookery, the egrets filling the trees, and the white flames their feathers made on the branches. He thought how much he would miss that. "It's not too soon," Dom Anthony was saying, "to schedule your ceremony for solemn vows." The old man began riffling the pages of a desk calendar. "I was thinking of the Nativity of St. John the Baptist on June 24th, or there's St. Barnabas on the 11th. "Solemn vows?" Whit repeated. He'd been so sure he was about to be asked to leave. He'd braced himself for the humiliation of that. He said it a second time. "Solemn vows?" Dom Anthony squinted up at him. "Yes, Brother Thomas. It's time to be thinking about making your petition." Exasperation tugged on his voice, the tone of a teacher with an absent-minded pupil. He picked up a pencil, holding it loosely, letting it rap on the desk like a drumstick. "Now, as for the ceremony, you're allowed to invite whomever you want. Are your parents living?"
"I don't know," said Whit.
Dom Anthony laid down the pencil and folded his hands together.
"You don't know? You don't know if your parents are dead or alive?"
"Yes, of course I know that," Whit said. "My mother is alive. What I meant is that..."
He looked at the Annunciation, aware of the abbot watching him. He'd been on the verge of saying he didn't know if he could take the vows, then stopped himself. He thought of Thomas Merton's prayer that he'd printed on a little blue card and kept taped to the mirror over his sink. "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. Reverend Father," he began, "I don't know about solemn vows. I'm not sure anymore about taking them." Dom Anthony pushed back his chair and stood with painful slowness. He stared a moment at the junior monk, sighing.
"Have you been reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer again?" he asked.
"No, Reverend Father."
The abbot had forbidden him to read any more of the Protestant theologian's writing after he'd found a certain unresolvable quotation of Bonhoeffer's copied into Whit's notebook. "Before and with God, we live without God." Whit had liked the searing honesty of that. It had seemed to capture the paradox he was always carrying around inside. Dom Anthony walked around the desk and laid his hand on Whit's shoulder. "I'm glad to hear you've set him aside. You're particularly sensitive to doubt, so it's best not to feed it, especially now that you've come to the point of taking vows. It's a dark night of testing that we've all gone through. You're not alone in that. You will be vowing to spend the rest of your life here, to die here, to own nothing at all, to be perfectly celibate, and to give yourself over to obedience. No one does this lightly. But we do it, just the same. We do it because the desire of our heart is God." The abbot smiled at him. "You will come through your dark night, Brother Thomas. Think of the disciple for whom you're named. Why do you think I chose that name for you? He doubted, didn't he?
But in the end, he overcame it with his faith. And you will too.
Dom Anthony returned to his chair as if it were all settled. The dark night, doubt, faith, all of it properly dissected, reassembled, and put in its proper place. Wit wanted to tell him that he should have taken the name Jonah, that he'd been swallowed into the abbey, that he'd been traveling in the dark, luminous belly of this place from the moment he'd arrived, but now he would be spit back into that other life. Phil, Oprah, Sally, Madonna's fishnet hose, Revenge of the Nerds movies, out there where normal people, even bank tellers, use the words totally awesome to describe the most banal things. He heard the chainsaw again, more distantly this time. He felt it in his chest. Dom Anthony was brooding over the calendar. Wit noticed the tufts of pale hair on his knuckles. Over his head, Mary's book was perpetually tumbling. What had he really been doing here? What if his being here wasn't about making peace with a god who was both here and not here, but more about finding some kind of immunity from life? What if he'd mixed up enlightenment with asylum? What if holiness had more to do with seizing his life out there? The abbot had said he should take his vows because the desire of his heart was for God. And he did want God, but he knew now he wanted Jesse more. He couldn't dismiss that. Neither his body nor his heart would let him, but neither would his soul. It was trying to tell him something. He was certain of it. One thing he'd learned from being here was how incessantly the soul tried to speak up, and usually in maddeningly cryptic ways. In his dreams, in the jumble of impressions and feelings he got when alone in the marsh, and occasionally in the symptoms in his body. That way he'd broken out in hives the time he was taken off rookery duty and made to help in the net house. Nowhere, though, did the soul speak more insistently than through desire. Sometimes the heart wanted what the soul demanded.
"I think the nativity of John the Baptist would be best," Dom Anthony said.
"I'm sorry, Reverend Father. I can't set the date now."
Wit lifted his chin. He crossed his arms over his chest and planted his feet in that wide, commanding stance he'd always used in court during his closing summations. A court reporter had compared him once to Napoleon, standing on a ship bow, dug in for battle.
"I can't because I don't know if I'll ever be able to take my vows. I don't know if the desire of my heart is God." The room filled with silence, a perfect silence. It pressed heavily in his ears, popping on his drums as if he were descending from the clouds in an airplane. Dom Anthony walked to the window and stood with his back to Wit. Minutes passed before he finally turned around. "You are to give yourself over to the dark night, then. You are to stay there as long as it takes you to find your faith and come to your decision. May God be with you." He raised his hand in dismissal. Walking to his cottage, Wit thought of the countless small things on the island he would miss. The alligators, cruising the creeks, submerged except for the great humps of their eyes. The oysters in their shells at night, how they opened when no one was looking. But mostly, the egrets, lifting out of the marsh, carrying the light on their backs. Chapter 28. I began to go alone to the marsh island in the rookery, paddling there in Hepzibah's old canoe, arriving well before Wit appeared on his rounds. I created a place for myself, a place where I felt hidden away with the blue crabs and the wading egrets. All through the rest of March and the first 2 weeks of April, I went to the island nearly every day, hungry for Wit, but driven, too, by an insatiable need to be alone. I told Mother the truth, at least partially.
that I was paddling around in the creeks, needing time to think through some things. She immediately leaped to the conclusion that I was thinking about my marriage. She had noticed my wedding rings on the pincushion in my room and asked repeatedly why Hugh had left the island so quickly, why he didn't call anymore. It was only Dee I spoke with now, weekly, on the phone, and if she was suspicious about my sustained absence from Atlanta, she didn't mention it.
"Your marriage is in trouble, isn't it?" Mother prodded.
And before I could form an answer, she said,
"Don't deny it. It's written all over you. And I don't see how you expect to fix things if all you're going to do is stay here and loaf around in the creeks."
She had carried on about this for days. Even when Cat and Hepzibah dropped by one day, Mother brought it up, launching into the details of my daily absences.
"Really," she said to them, "how much piddling around can a person actually do out there all by herself? It's like she's reverted to her childhood, back when she and Mike stayed out there the better part of the day."
Hepzibah and Cat exchanged glances. "I've been going out there to think and be alone," I rushed to say. When the two of them left, I followed them onto the porch. "I do meet him," I said, "every afternoon for a couple of hours, but most of the time that I'm out there, I'm alone. I don't know why. I just need to be by myself."
"Sounds like you're traveling," Hepzibah said.
I stared a moment, wondering what she meant before remembering what she'd said on the tour that day about the Gullah people going off to the woods. I'm sure my solitary visitations to the rookery represented some kind of migration, but I doubt they were as lofty as the visits the Gullah people made. Mine were decidedly sensual, a kind of affair with myself and with the island, and of course, with Wit. I do know this. They obscured everything else. All my concerns about Mother, why she'd been reading the books from the monastery library, the notion that she'd been involved in some kind of white martyrdom. It was easy to overlook now because of how much better she seemed. Cooking for the monks, busy, industrious, normal. It was I who began to indulge in strange behavior, outrageous, extravagant acts that would have been unthinkable 2 months earlier. One afternoon, right after the spring equinox, I sat beside Witt's hermitage, watching a willet build a nest in the marsh, and listening to David Bowie sing "Let's Dance" on a Walkman I'd found at Caw Caw General. The day was almost sultry, and the periwinkle snails sat along the cord grass in their little stupors. Egrets, oyster catchers, and herons were crowded into the shallows so thickly it looked like an Audubon parking lot. Noticing a small diamondback terrapin nearby, what Mike used to call a cooter, I got up and followed it. The creature reminded me of the turtle skull permanently installed now on top of the crab trap in the hermitage, which in turn reminded me of Cat, Hepzibah, and Mother dancing at the all-girls' picnics. Picturing them, I began to sway a little. I'd never danced at the picnics. It had been their thing. Later, as an adult, I'd felt self-conscious dancing, too inhibited even to do it alone. But that day, with David Bowie insisting in my ear, "Let's dance, let's dance," I began to do so with complete abandon. The skirt on my white muslin sundress flaring out like Isadora Duncan's. I loved the feel of my body moving like that, doing what it wanted. Each day, I took the Walkman to the island and danced to whatever cassettes I could find in Caw Caw, Julio Iglesias and Willie Nelson singing "To All the Girls I've Loved Before," Stevie Wonder's "Woman in Love," the soundtrack to Dirty Dancing. I even bought Pink Floyd. Afterward, breathless and spent, I would lie down beside the pluff mud and pat the shining black muck along my arms and legs as if I were having a skin treatment at the spa. The goo smelled warm, alive, chlorophyll green, and rotten as the paper mills near Savannah, but I needed it. I cannot even tell you why it was. I suppose an irrational act. I would actually lie there with mud caked and drying on my skin, and luxuriate in it for an hour or more, watching the sky reflected in the water and feeling the enduring breath of the earth moving around me. One afternoon, when Wit failed to show up because of a flooded toilet in the monastery reception center, I watched the sun set and the water's surface bleed into carnelian and topaz. I heard dolphins pass, spewing their breath, and when the quiet became overbearing, I listened to the crackling advance of fiddler crabs on the mudflats and the tiny pops of pistol shrimp snapping their claws together. During those times, I sank into the compost of the island and became inseparable from it. It was only when my skin began to tighten and itch to the point I wanted to claw it that I would plunge into the water and swim away the mud. With my skin pink and vibrating, I would recline on the tides and let myself float. Once they carried me across the circular pool along the tributary back into Caw Caw Creek, and I had to vie with a deceptively strong ebb to get back to the island. More than the dancing or the mud bathing, it was the water I reveled in, traveling water. It was filled with decay and death, and at the same time with plankton and eggs and burgeoning life. It would recede, stripping everything in its path, then turn into a brimming, amniotic estuary. I needed it like air. I never told Wit about these things, though he had to know I'd been swimming, and maybe he guessed at the rest. Every afternoon he would find me waiting for him, with soggy hair and telltale traces of marsh mud in the creases of my elbows. I look back now at my Dionysian tangent and understand it only a little better, how I was opening to the most rhapsodic thing in myself. To some extent, those days were governed by instinct and flesh. When I was hungry, I ate what I'd brought from home, typically gorging myself on apples. And when I was sleepy, I simply lay down on one of Mother's discarded bedspreads and napped. But at the heart of it all, I believe that Hepzibah was right. I was traveling. I took over Wit's crab trap, draped it with a cast net, and gradually gathered a little assemblage of things to go with the turtle skull. Osprey feathers, clusters of blossoming trumpet flowers, oyster and bivalve shells, a crab claw I'd found at the water's edge. On a whim, I added the so-called mermaid tears to the mix, the small pebbles I'd picked up in Cat's shop the first time I'd visited it. There were half a dozen apple peelings on top of the trap, too, my pathetic attempt at making whirligirls, which had ended up as a mass of broken red tendrils. One day, while rummaging in my bag for a comb, I took out my father's pipe and added that to the collection as well. Each day when I left the island, I stored everything in a plastic bag, which I tucked inside the trap, then faithfully reassembled when I returned. At first I thought I was following Hepzibah's example and making my own tiny show-and-tell table. Then it occurred to me that maybe I was trying to domesticate the hermitage, decorate it, make it ours. Was I playing house? I caught Wit staring at the arrangement once, the way it sat beneath the palmetto leaf cross he'd nailed on the wall. "Is it an altar?" he asked, startling me. I would often set up my palette and canvas inside the hermitage and paint one diving woman after another. I painted her from different angles, capturing her in progressive stages of the dive. The water around her changed colors with each canvas, going through a succession of violet blues, greens, yellow oranges, and finally, fiery Pompeian reds. Sometimes the diving woman, always nude, was done with pre-Raphaelite realism and attention to detail. And other times she was a black shape, rimmed in gold, primitive and stylized, but always, to me at least, radiant in her descent. Some paintings showed her letting go of an odd stream of paraphernalia that floated back to the surface as she plunged deeper. Spatulas, refrigerator magnets, kitchen bric-a-brac, wedding rings, crucifixes, charred wood, apple peels, a tiny pair of plastic kissing geese. Yes, of course I realized that the paintings were a series of self-portraits. How could I not? Yet I didn't control them. They came like eruptions, like geysers. I didn't know when the diving would stop, what spectrum of the rainbow the water would turn next, where the bottom was, or what might happen when the woman reached it. Around mid-afternoon each day, I would begin to watch for Wit. By the time he arrived on the island, I would be in a frenzy of desire. We would twine ourselves together in the hermitage and make love, growing more and more fluent with each other's bodies, muttering our love over and over. I felt drunk with happiness and passion during those meetings, with a sense of having come home, but at the same time of making an exodus, of flying away to an eternal place. After making love, we talked until he had to leave. Lying in his arms, I told him once about Chagall's Lovers in the Red Sky, how the pair, some thought Chagall and his wife Bella, were wrapped in a glorious knot, how they floated above the world. "But they can't stay up there forever," Wit had said. And I'd felt a slight deflation, an unease. Only now and then did we talk about any kind of future. We both assumed there would be one, but we weren't ready to act on it. That seemed precipitous to both of us. Part of him, a quiet, concealed part that I loved and feared at the same time, was saying a grievous goodbye to the monastery, to his life there. And somewhere inside of me, I suppose I was saying goodbye too, to 20 years of marriage, though in all honesty, I consciously tried not to think about it. What I did think about relentlessly during those hours on the island was my father. He seemed like a ghost hovering over the hermitage roof and everywhere in the needle rush. Again and again, I would go back in my mind to the day the monks came to the door, bearing the burned remains of his boat, the stoic way Mother had built the fire in the fireplace and tossed the boards on the flames. Watching them burn had been the first time I'd felt the deep crevice his dying was to make in my life. During Easter week, I saw Wit only once. His work in the rookery was suspended while he assisted Brother Bede with Passiontide. All the high and holy preparations that had to be carried out between Palm Sunday and the Easter Vigil. The matter of Easter lilies, holy oil, paschal candles, the basin and pitcher for the foot washing, black vestments, white vestments. He did not get there until Thursday, Maundy Thursday, or as Mother had said that morning, reverting to her Catholic Latin, Feria Quinta in Cena Domini, the Thursday of the Lord's Supper. Wearing the aqua shirt he loved, I met him at the edge of the water and waited while he anchored the John boat. I fixed a picnic on a red and white floral tablecloth that I'd spread nearby. Mother's Wadmala tomato pie. Strawberries, Market Street pralines, a bottle of red wine. Clusters of wild white azaleas that I'd picked in Cat's front yard filled the center of the cloth. When Wit saw what I'd done, he bent over and kissed my forehead.
"This is a surprise. What's the occasion?"
"Well, let me see." I pretended to be racking my brain. "It is Maundy Thursday. Plus, it happens to be our 6-week and 1-day anniversary."
"We have an anniversary?"
"Of course we do. February 17th, the day we met. It was Ash Wednesday, remember? It hasn't always been the most cheerful day of the year for me, so I thought I'd turn it into an anniversary."
"I see."
We sat down on the tablecloth, and he reached for the wine. I'd forgotten cups, so we each took a swig straight from the bottle, laughing when it dribbled down my chin. As I sliced the tomato pie and placed the thick wedges on paper plates, I went on talking, caught up in my delirious chatter. "The first year, we'll celebrate our anniversary monthly on the 17th, and then we'll mark it annually, every Ash Wednesday." When I looked up, he was no longer smiling. I set the plate down. I had the terrible feeling he was going to tell me we would not be having annual anniversaries, that he decided to stay at the Abbey. What if Easter had gotten to him, God resurrecting? I went cold. He reached for me, holding me almost painfully close. "We could live near Asheville," he said, "at the end of some dirt road in the middle of nowhere, and hike on weekends. Or go to Malaprop's bookstore and sit in the cafe." I realized then that he was simply affected by the thought of having a life in which there would be small domestic details and a flow of days, of anniversaries. It was as if it had all somehow just become real to him. "I would love that," I told him. But in truth, it made me uncomfortable. Hiking is what Hugh and I had done. Weekends in the mountains north of Atlanta, in a little place called Mineral Bluff. Later, after we'd eaten, bees flitted in the azalea blossoms, and Whit told an outlandish story about a 3-foot alligator that had gotten into the church the second year he was at the monastery, and how, upon seeing it, the abbot had leaped up onto the altar. I leaned back on my elbows and placed my bare feet in his lap. I fed myself the last of the strawberries while he rubbed my feet. He said something about brides having their feet washed before the wedding, that it was an old custom. I don't remember now if he said it was biblical or Asian, just that it was the kind of obscure antediluvian trivia only Whit would know. He slid closer to the edge of the water, tugging me with him, scooping handfuls of water from the creek. He poured it over my feet, sliding his hands across my wet skin. He moved them slowly over my ankles, stroked the arches of my feet with his thumbs, then let his fingers slide in and out between my toes. I watched him without speaking. I didn't know what covenant we were making, but I felt it in his hands and saw it in his face. I closed my eyes and felt myself going down with a diving woman. Somewhere in my paintings, there was a place of no return. Chapter 29. On the evening of the all-girls picnic, Mother balked. She stood on the front porch holding a bag of Benny wafers, wearing a navy cotton shirt with a collar all wrinkled and baggy beige pants stretched out at the elastic waist, and informed Cat, Hepzibah, Benny, and me that she would not be going. She had washed her hair earlier and let it dry naturally, which had caused a wild white wave to rise straight up from her forehead and splash down on top of her head, flipping out erratically.
"Oh, for the love of God," said Cat. "How pig-headed can one woman be? Am I gonna have to go get the damn hibiscus scarf again?"
Mother jabbed her fists onto her hips. "I'm not worried about my hand, Cat Bowers."
"Well, what is it? It is because of your hair?"
"What's wrong with my hair?" Mother practically shouted.
"Cat fight," said Benny.
Hepzibah stepped between them.
"What is wrong with you two, Lord?"
"Mother, look, I understand your reluctance," I said, "but we fixed all this food. The golf carts are loaded, and Hepzibah has already gathered the wood for a fire down on the beach. We've got our hearts set on this."
"Then, by all means, go without me."
"We're not going without you," said Cat. "It's all of us or none of us, that's the deal."
There was the reason my father had called them the Three Egretiers. The unspoken deal. That tiny, cemented knot they'd tied in their threads and tossed into the ocean. We went on coaxing, making good use of guilt, ignoring her excuses, until she finally climbed into one of the carts. I wish now I'd listened to her, that one of us had had the decent foresight to listen. Not even Benny caught the quiet, dire quality echoing inside her resistance. It was the first Saturday after Easter, April 16th, 6 p.m., we decided not to wait until May Day Eve, when the all-girl picnics had traditionally been held in the past. Mother needed this now, we'd reasoned. The day was warm, with bright, sparkly afternoon light gleaming off the edges of things. I drove behind Cat, following her through the dunes and sea oats, right down onto Boneyard Beach. The wind was hitting the waves and breaking open the tops of them, releasing sudden belches of spray. Max, who'd ridden over in the back seat of my cart, jumped out while we were still moving, tearing for the water. Hepzibah had piled the driftwood in a heap, far up on the beach, anticipating high tide. "Watch where you park," I heard her tell Cat as we braked, a loaded comment referring to the time Cat had left her golf cart on the beach and the tide took it. She'd come back hours later to see it bobbing off toward England. We spread out a blanket on the sand, and Mother sat down, huddling on the corner, farthest from the water, gathering an old alpaca sweater around her shoulders. She positioned her back to the water and stared at the dunes. There was a weirdness about that, like someone on an elevator facing the back wall instead of the doors. I could feel her retreating, being sucked back into the old darkness. 2 weeks ago, when I'd taken her to Mount Pleasant for her follow-up appointment with the doctor, she'd sat inside the ferry and stared carefully at the floor, as if she didn't want to be reminded of what had happened out on the water 33 years ago. Her behavior now reminded me of that. Had she had this aversion to the island waters ever since Dad died, and somehow I'd just not noticed? It struck me as the same unaccountable antagonism she'd harbored for the mermaid chair. That, too, had started after he died. I had seen her leave the room at the mere mention of it. I kept on observing her as I unpacked the food. We'd gone out of our way to bring the same dishes as before. Crab cakes, Hop and John, pimento cheese, raisin bread pudding, wine, Chianti for Cat, Chardonnay for the rest of us. Looking at the spread, I thought of Wit and the picnic I'd made for us a little over a week before on the opposite side of the island. The way he'd bathed my feet, the unspoken ceremony it had become, full of faint, connubial undertones. Max had settled into his favorite sport, catching sand crabs, trotting up to us with legs and claws hanging out of his mouth. I watched him bring one to Mother, dropping it proudly at her feet, and the limp, distracted way she placed her hand on his head. She had not said 3 words. Cat handed her the saran wrap, asking her to find the end of it, and Mother simply laid it down on the sand without trying. If the point was to cheer Mother up, it wasn't working. Something was deeply wrong. Cat, however, would not relent. Her attempts to draw Mother into the evening, to consummate the vision we all had of her reverting miraculously to her all-girls picnic self, became increasingly forced.
"Nell, who do you think should be our first female president? Geraldine Ferraro or Patricia Schroeder?" Cat asked.
This barely got a shrug out of her.
"Come on. You have to answer. Jesse and Hepzibah say Patricia. I say Geraldine."
"Nancy Reagan," Mother muttered. We all perked up, thinking she was going to join in. The salvation of Nell Dubois at hand.
"Well, if Nancy runs, I, for one, will just say no," Cat said.
It was the kind of goading usually guaranteed to get Mother going. But there was no comeback, nothing but the sinking of her shoulders into their former slump. She ate only a little, half a crab cake and a spoonful of bread pudding. The rest of us loaded our plates, still determined. As darkness materialized out over the ocean, Hepzibah lit the fire. The wind-dried wood flamed up quickly. Within moments it was raging, spattering the air with sparks that trailed off into the blackness. We sat in a globe of light, the smell of burning everywhere, and no one considered how a fire blazing right there beside the water might affect a woman for whom fire and water meant nothing but tragedy and death. A woman who could not look seawater in the face, who'd boarded up her fireplace. We were blinded by nostalgia for the woman she'd been before all of that. It makes me weep now to think how hard Mother must have been trying that night. How she came only to please us and went on sitting there as her agony grew. Throughout the evening, she remained at the edge of the blanket, back where the light didn't reach. Hepzibah beat her gullah drum. The sound came out lamenting and slow. Benny laid her head in Cat's lap, and Max fell asleep with a gloss of firelight on his back. The wood crackled. The ocean heaved, slamming down on the beach. No one talked. We had given up. Sometime around 3 a.m., hours after our bonfire had turned to embers and we'd packed up our failed experiment and left the beach, I was wakened in my bed by someone calling my name. I recall it as a shrill, urgent whisper. Jessie? I sat up. Confused, surfacing, my head gummed with sleep. I could see a shape, a person, shadowed in the doorway. My heart began a wild, adrenaline-soaked pounding. I fumbled for the lamp switch beside the bed, tipping over a glass of water that spilled across the table onto the floor.
I'm sorry. I had to,
a voice said. Mother? The shock of lamplight cut through the room, blinding me for a moment. Squinting, I swept my hand through the air as if I could wipe the glare out of it. Her face appeared dazed, her hand lifted as if she were a student asking permission to speak. Blood was everywhere. Soaked across the front of a pale nylon gown, winding in streams down her forearm, pelting the floor.
I had to, she said again, repeating it I don't know how many times, a hysterical whisper that seemed to incapacitate me.
For several seconds, I didn't move, speak, blink. I stared hypnotically at the blood coursing from her hand, the dazzling brightness of it, the way it flowed in small, measured spurts. I was blunted with awe, floating in the moment of blessed disconnection that comes before panic, before the full tonnage of the moment drops. But even then, I did not leap from bed in a frenzy. I rose slowly and moved toward her as if weightless, one foot and then the other, transfixed with horror. The little finger on her right hand was missing. I lashed Mother's forearm with a belt, creating a tourniquet. She lay on the floor while I compressed a towel tightly against the gaping place where her little finger had been, aware all of a sudden that she could die. My mother could bleed to death on the floor of my bedroom, on the spot near the window where I'd strung whirligirls. There was no emergency service on the island, no doctor. When the towel ran red, I got another. Mother became still. The color was sliding out of her face. As the hemorrhage finally began to stop, I dialed Kat's number with one hand, bearing down on her wound with the other one. Kat arrived with Shem, who, despite his age, grasped Mother in his burly arms and carried her outside to the golf cart. I walked beside them, keeping steady pressure on Mother's hand. At the ferry dock, he lifted her once again and bore her onto the pontoon. He was breathing hard, but talking to her the whole way. Stay with us now, Nell. Stay with us. Inside the boat, he laid her on the passenger bench, instructing us to keep her feet elevated. Cat held them aloft for the entire trip, and Mother, still conscious but drifting somewhere far away from us, gazed at the roof of the boat for a while before finally closing her eyes. Cat and I did not exchange a word. We crossed the rolling black water while the wind moved like smoke, and the blood on Mother's gown dried, turning to a stiff, brown crust. A waning three-quarter moon loomed over us. I watched its light, soft as mohair, collect around Mother's head, and wondered if she'd used a meat cleaver. Had there been one, hidden somewhere in the kitchen that I'd missed? After Cat had arrived, I'd looked for Mother's finger, thinking the doctor might be able to reattach it.
I'd expected to find it lying on the cutting board like a discarded vegetable peel, but it had been nowhere in sight, just puddles of blood everywhere. That trip across the bay was like being jerked out of the sea on a barbed hook and hauled back into reality. Back to where you know all over again, there is no immunity, no storm tent, no illusion. Mother's ruthless, mutilating compulsion had been there all along, consuming her like cancer. And I had been engrossed elsewhere. Until tonight, I'd actually thought we were making progress. That three steps forward, two steps backward kind of advance, slow and frustrating, but still progress. The mind is so good at revising reality to suit our needs. I had seen what I wanted. I had reinvented the objectionable, the most indigestible pieces of my life into something just palatable enough to bear. I had taken Mother's craziness and normalized it. How do I describe how flattened I felt by the depth of her madness? By my own passivity and denial and guilt. I turned my face to the plastic window on the boat. Behind us, the island was swallowed in darkness. The water seemed immense.